Good morning. It's good to see you this morning. If you could sing through that last song without a smile on your face, I don't know if I want to know your secret. So I want to ask you, I talked to the kids this morning a little bit about what they would do or what they would say if they needed to convince someone of something, try their favorite food maybe. What would it take to convince you? I want you to think about maybe a time in your life where you had someone who desperately wanted to convince you to try something that you had no intention of trying or no intention of doing. Maybe it was a movie that you didn't want to see, had no interest in it, hadn't heard anything about it, and someone convinced you, someone talked you into going and seeing it. Or maybe it was a new book. You read all the authors that you knew, all their books they had, and weren't sure what to do next, and someone convinced you, talked you into reading or trying a new book. Or maybe a food, like we talked about with the kids this morning. Maybe it was a food. Doesn't look good, doesn't sound good, but someone talked you into trying it. What did it take to convince you? This is an audience participation part for just a minute. I want you to tell the person you're sitting with, what does it take to convince you to try something new? Or what did it take? What did a person have to do to talk you into it? Take just a second, 10 seconds or so, and tell the people you're sitting with. All right, how many of you said something along the lines of, they knew what they were talking about? It was clear that they had put a lot of thought into it, and they had good reasons to explain to me why I should try it. Anybody say something along those lines? Or maybe it was the persistence level. They just wouldn't stop talking about it. I mean, any parent knows what that's like, right? To just be talked to death until you finally, all right, I'll do it. Or if you're like me, it has less to do with any of those things than it does with enthusiasm. If someone is genuinely enthusiastic or takes joy in something, it makes me curious. Especially if I can see, and in some real way, because of their enthusiasm, that it has meant something to them, that it has changed them in some way, that it really had that sort of level of impact. Because joy and enthusiasm is contagious. To sing a song like we sang before I got up here, or one that we're going to sing in just a minute, it's hard to sing the words. It's hard to not get caught up in what is being said. And if you can sit there with a sour look on your face and go through it all, then I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do it. The psalm that we want to look at this morning, Psalm 34, is a psalm that is so desperately trying to convince its audience to do one thing. The whole psalm is structured around one idea, and it's this: taste and see. The Lord is good. That's what they're trying to do. The rest of the psalm is constructed to try to get his audience to taste and see that the Lord is good. That is what the psalmist wants to do. That is his main goal. And he will hold up his own life experiences as proof that we should taste and see that the Lord is good. He's going to say, I want you to know what I've been through and seen what I've seen. And then he makes some statements of faith, what he believes, what he has learned about who God is based on his experiences that has led him to say, the Lord is good. Please try it for yourself. And so there's a lot to unpack with this psalm. But before we get there, before we do that, because sometimes I think I know I can do this. I can get lost inside of the forest only looking at the trees and not really experience what it's like as a whole. And so what I want us to do is we're going to sing a song that gets at the overwhelming force of this psalm, which is joy. It's enthusiasm for faith, for his belief in God. So we're going to sing another song that we learned yesterday called Psalm 34. Surprise, it takes its words directly from Psalm 34. And I want us to sing this so we can capture and get a sense of the joy of the psalmist and that he has for his belief in God. So if you would, please stand one more time as we sing.
Super quick word about this song. We're going to get about halfway through this song, and then it's going to break into four separate parts. So if you're a soprano, an alto, a tenor, or a bass, it's kind of got to feel like the Greatest Commandments where everybody sings a little bit something different, and you might feel a little lost. That's okay. That's okay. We're going to just listen to those people who are around you and try to follow along as best you can, and then we'll all come back together after that section is over, and it'll be great.
I sought the Lord, and He answered me.
Us to know one thing. The psalmist wants to lay all his cards on the table and tell us exactly where he's coming from, exactly where his heart is. He begins the psalm in this way: I will bless the Lord at all times, and his praise shall continually be in my mouth. And so if you are a cynic, you might begin to think we're dealing with a crazy person. Because how is that really possible? Can we really praise the Lord at all times? Is his praise going to be in our mouth continually? We read passages like this. We read other passages in the New Testament that talk about offering our prayers of thanks to God continuously. And we ask ourselves, what do we do with that? We might be tempted to pass off what he's saying as a metaphor or as hyperbole, right? He's exaggerating to get a point across. But I think if we do that, we're missing an important idea at play. The word bless is more like the idea that you find in Psalm 16 and Psalm 26, where the meaning has more to do with kneeling before the sovereign in submission to his rule. So when the psalmist says, I will bless the Lord at all times, what he's getting at is that I will kneel before my ruler. I will submit myself to his reign. I will recognize him as sovereign of my life at all times, not only in what I say, but in particular in what I do. And then he says, his praise will be in my mouth always or continuously. And the word praise here is the same Hebrew word as the word for boast. And the idea is that he is offering up his entire self, his whole self, to God. Now, while challenging, that is something that we can do. While challenging, it is possible for us to take captive, to take hold of everything that we do and make it submit to God. It means that not only when I'm here on a Sunday morning, but when I'm living my life, interacting at work or at school or on the road, or at the grocery store when someone's not getting out of your way fast enough. At all times, I'm kneeling before God, making my life submissive to him. The psalmist says, I am giving my whole life to God. His praise. I will bless him at all times, not only in what I say, which probably is a part of it, but especially in what I do. Because this is about who we are. And how who we are impacts everything that we do in life. And while that's a challenge, what he's saying is all the moments, big and small, belong to God. And he gives us three invitations. He offers us three invitations as to what to do or what that might look like. He says, oh, magnify the Lord with me, exalt his name together. Verse 3. This is a call for us to do this as a community. For us to bless the Lord, to praise his name together. Magnify means to make great the name of the Lord. To exalt his name means to lift it up. I want you to think about what that might mean for us as a community. Certainly it means what we're doing this morning, what we did last night, where we come together and with one voice we sing praise to God. We tell of his excellent nature. We tell of the things that he has done for us. But I think another part of making his name great, magnifying his name for the world to see, is what we do in our community as a community. We exalt his name before our friends, our family, before the people who are surrounding us in these houses over on the golf course and all around. We magnify his name in the ways we choose to serve. When we go down and we feed the homeless, when we engage in service work, that's how we magnify his name together. Certainly it includes what we do here this morning, but it also is a way of being, it's a way of living, and the psalmist invites us to do that. It goes beyond just a personal sort of piety, but instead it calls us together as community. And in verse 8 he says the famous line, right? Taste and see that the Lord is good. I want you to think about that metaphor. Taste, it's my mouth, but I see it. It's like I want to say something so that my friends will see what I'm talking about. It's an interesting metaphor, right? And I want you to think about what he's saying, what this invitation really is. It's an invitation to experience God in a very personal and real way. You know, sometimes when we want to convince our friends or convince people to do something, usually we start with, you know, just like put your toe in the water, right? If we've gotten in a cold pool and we want everybody else to jump in, it's not so bad. Just, you know, like dip your toe in the water. Or we want to tell them about something and it's like more of a from afar sort of experience. That's not what's being offered here. That's not what we're being invited to do. To taste is to ingest, to take as a part of yourself. To taste and see that the Lord is good isn't to try to maybe experience it from way off in a very peripheral sort of way. I may just read a little bit about it. To taste and see is to experience God, to make him and his word and his will a part of your life. And the psalmist says, if you do that, you're going to see. You're going to see that the Lord is good. And then the third invitation in verse 9, he says, fear the Lord, you saints. Fear the Lord, O you saints, for those who fear him have no lack. We're going to talk a little bit more in a minute about what fear means, but in Deuteronomy, fearing God is virtually synonymous with obeying God's commandments. And so we sometimes think of fear as being sort of a cowering and being afraid. And while there are parts of Scripture that deal with that level of fear of God, this is more about reverence. It's more about obeying God because I realize who I am, and who I am is not God. Who I am is someone who has a very limited set of experiences and abilities, and I cannot and will not and should not do this on my own. And so I bow before the one who has a greater wisdom and understanding of my own life and the world around me. And so a fear of God isn't I'm afraid of him, but I realize who he is and who I am. And in response to that, I realize that I need to do whatever it is he wants me to. Because not only does he know best, he knows what is best. And then the psalmist gives us an explanation for this praise and devotion. You can see it throughout the psalm, how dedicated he is to God, how he has offered his whole life up to God, and you wonder what could inspire that level of devotion. And it's interesting, if you notice at the top of Psalm 34, there's an ascription to the part of David's life where this psalm came from. And if you go and you trace that, it goes back to 1 Samuel chapter 21. And this is a really interesting story because you read this psalm and you think, man, this is someone, he is on top. Right? He is living a good, this is good. His life is great. Then you go and you read that psalm and you realize this is early in David's career. This is not later in life when things are going well for him or in the glory days of David's reign. This is in the moments when he is running for his life. Saul is after him and he is trying to escape. And he comes to one area and there's some of Saul's followers and they're going, isn't this David? No, that's Barbara's boy. No, that's David. This is the one that they say, you know, Saul has killed his thousands, but David is tens of thousands, and David knows what that means. He knows these guys loyal to Saul are about to come after him, and so what does he do? He pretends to be insane, and the psalm Samuel says he lets spittle drip down his beard, and he acts like a crazy person. This is the moment in David's life where he says, taste and see that the Lord is good. David is at a low moment in his life, but notice what he says. He offers up this experience of his life, and he says in verse 4, but I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and he delivered me. He delivered me from all of my fear. In verse 6, he says, this poor, humble man cried, and the Lord heard him. You can almost imagine him just like, I can't even believe it. And saved him out of all of his trouble. I'm 100% sure there are people here this morning who could share stories that mirror David's life. Maybe if not in the particulars, at least in the general feeling. There are people here who could share stories, examples of where you were in a low moment, a dark night of your soul, if you will, and you sought God and he answered you. If you are that person, this is a song for you to sing. But it may be that you are who David has in mind earlier in the psalm when he says, I hope the humble will hear and be glad. And by humble, he means those who are poor and needy. So it may be that you are who David has in mind. It may be that you are currently in need of rescuing. Where the dark night just seems to be stretching on, and you don't know what to do with your pain, your doubt, your grief, your anger, this is a song for you to sing. It's a song that recognizes that those moments happen in life, even to the righteous, because the psalmist David says later on, the afflictions of the righteous are many. But this is a song to sing that reminds us that rescue can be yours. And so whether you have been, are, or will someday be, this psalm is one for you to sing. To either remind yourself of where you've been, to remind yourself of where you will go, this is a psalm for all of us. And then David wants us to know some things that he's learned. He's learned that the Lord hears, and the Lord cares for those who fear him. Verse 7 says, "The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them. Fear the Lord," he says, "for those who fear him have no lack." So at the heart of this psalm, the taste and see that the Lord is good for those who fear him. So what does that look like then, to fear God? What can be said of those who fear him? I think there are two basic elements. And depending on the kind of person you are, you're going to find yourself having camped out maybe in one of these areas or the other. But this psalm holds these two together, saying there cannot be one without the other for those who fear God. And the first is a being. The first is a sense of being, of a recognizing of who you are. Right? This is a place of prayer. This is a place where you realize that life has let you down and that you cannot do it alone and that you are in need of God. This is the poor and the lowly state of being, right? This is where he talks about in verse 2, "My soul makes it boast, let the humble hear and be glad." In verse 8, "Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him." Those who need refuge are those who are being attacked. And we realize we can't do it on our own. I can't take refuge in my own power. I can't take refuge in my own ability to handle or to deal with this. And so I recognize that I am a needy person that needs to cry to God for deliverance. He says in 10, "The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing." It's an interesting metaphor, right? To say these powerful animals that can go and fend and do for themselves, they still want for hunger, but those who seek not their own power or their own way or will, but who seek God's, are the ones who have no lack. And then verse 18 probably speaks the loudest to me, if not maybe a lot of us. "The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and those who are crushed in spirit." There may be times in your life where you are the brokenhearted, you are the crushed in spirit, and you were over here in a state where you knew you needed to cry to God for supplication. You needed to go to God for deliverance. Then there is another side of things that maybe more of us might find ourselves in, and it is the doing side. It is the side that takes action. It is the side that is on the move and deals with ethical types of issues. He says in verse 13, "Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit." Part of those who fear God are those who make themselves obedient to God's word. "I watch what I say so that I will be blessing God and not representing a false side of God by speaking evil or telling lies, maybe to others, but maybe also to myself about what is true and right." But he also says to avoid evil, turn away from evil and do good, seek peace and pursue it. Micah 6:8. The side of doing says it's not enough for me to just avoid doing wrong. I have to be willing to go and do good. I have to seek the good. I have to seek peace. I have to pursue those things. So it is not enough, though, to be one or the other. Verses 15 through 17 says, "The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, his ears toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. So when the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them from all their trouble." The righteous, those who are upright and doing right, and those who are crying out to God, are one and the same. To be people who fear the Lord, we recognize that we are in a place where we need God and cannot do it on our own, but we also realize that we have a responsibility to make God's name great, to seek peace in this world, to pursue righteousness. It's not simply enough to be needy. It is the followers of God who have already made the Lord the basis and guide for the conduct of their life, and it's those around whom the angel of the Lord sets up camp. The psalmist wants so desperately for us to understand the goodness of the Lord. And so he ends this way with the ultimate promise of and proof of the goodness of the Lord. Look with me at verse 22 of Psalm 34. The Lord redeems the life of his servants. None of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. That's the ultimate promise for those who fear the Lord. That is the ultimate reason why we can take joy in him, why we can taste and see and know that the Lord is good, because the ultimate promise, the ultimate point, is that David has experienced his share of heartbreak and loss, and he speaks now as one with perspective, one who can say life isn't always fair, it isn't always perfect or easy. We aren't always exempt from the pain that life often offers, but for those who fear the Lord and take refuge in him, we are redeemed, drawn out of one world and one way of understanding the world into God's way. In striking contrast to what culture wants to say or teach us, Psalm 34 teaches us that life begins with fearing God. It is a gift from God for which he makes gracious provision. If life is defined the way our culture defines it, there is no allowance for suffering or for the comprehension of the human dilemma. In other words, there is no possibility for happiness beyond just the most shallow experiences. But as one writer pointed out, the fear of the Lord establishes joy and fulfillment in all of life's experiences. It may mend the broken heart, but it doesn't prevent the heart from being broken. It may restore the spiritually crushed, but it does not crush the forces that create that oppression. And so the psalmist experiences life amid the suffering and not beyond it. His understanding of God's ultimate promise is what allows him to say, those who look upon him are radiant. You ever thought about that? Those who look upon him are radiant, because we recognize that as bad as things could get, as bad as things may be, we know where our hope and salvation ultimately lies. And knowing that those of us who fear him, take refuge in him, cry to him for help, we will be redeemed and we will not be condemned. And that is why he can ultimately, with joy and enthusiasm, despite the circumstances, say, just taste and see. The Lord is good. Just give him a chance. This morning, we offer you that invitation. Always, the invitation is for prayer, to give your life to God. But this morning, we also want to make sure you know the invitation is to taste and see. Maybe you've been from afar, trying to dip your toe in the water, just a little bit here and there. We ask you to dive all the way in, to experience God for yourself, and see if you don't come to the same conclusion, that the Lord is good. Please stand with us as we sing our final song.